Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks, we are now at part three of chapter one, Touching Greatness, Denali 63. We left off at the end of part two at 16,800 feet on the west buttress when Mike came running up wild-eyed, hollering, "My pack, my pack, my pack fell off the ridge." Oh, it's not poetry. It was bad. Let's see what happened next. Stove or summit. When Dick and Mike stopped for a rest, they piled their rope on the snow between them, but unfortunately put their packs on the rope pile. When Dick took a few steps down the ridge to get a picture, the rope from his waist pulled on the pile and tossed Mike's pack off the far side of the ridge. It was a steep slope, and the pack vanished in a wink. Dick and Mike dashed over to watch it bounce down for 1,000 feet. Then, to their continued horror, they watched the pack's contents spill out and roll down the slope in all directions for another 600 feet. One by one, little black dots came to rest in the glacier basin between the west buttress and Denali's northwest ridge. The loss of Mike's pack stunned us. Trying to think, I looked at Mike. "We have to keep our cool, man. What important things were in your pack, Mike?" Mike thought carefully, then replied, "Two sleeping bags, parka, pots, and both stoves." We all gasped. "Two sleeping bags, both stoves?" Mike went on, "Yes, both stoves. I traded out some heavy stuff with Dick for bulky stuff, trying to get a better balanced load. An old gotcha had us. We had put all our stoves in one pack. We could improvise for missing sleeping bags, parka, and pack, but we had to have at least one stove. Without a stove, we could not melt snow for water, and without water, we would not survive long. The mountain had played a very big card, and suddenly we were in trouble. Mike started moaning, "It's all my fault. Both stoves gone, and I did it. I've blown the summit for the whole team. It's all my fault." This emotional outburst startled Dick, but Joff and I knew Mike. We shot each other a quick summit club look, then launched into our well-oiled starting line routine. I began with, "Hold it in, Mike. It's not your fault. It's not anybody's fault. It just happened. Okay? Now, we've got to hold it in, or we really will have a problem." Joff continued the patter. "Now we're going to solve this dilemma and go on to the summit. We have our spare stove down at 14,200 feet, and maybe we can climb down to get the lost stuff." Mike blurted, "I'll go! I've got to go!" I replied in my best voice, "Hold it in, Mike. We've got to think this through. For starters, let's go see what the downclimb looks like." Mike was calmer when we walked over to the edge, focused on the physical problem, and analyzed our position. We had to have a stove, so we had to go down one side of the ridge or the other. The advantage going back to 14,200 feet was that the route was already in, and we knew that we had a working stove there. The disadvantage of this scenario was that we would still be short two sleeping bags, pack, and parka. The advantage of going down after the pack was that we could recover most of the vital stuff. The disadvantage was that it was new territory with unknown dangers. In the fading light, we peered over the edge for a better look. We saw little black dots on the glacier below, and there was a smooth snow slope all the way down to the dots, so it was no worse than the headwall. After a pregnant moment, we decided to go after the pack. Mike piped up instantly, "I'll go!" I countered, "Slow down, Mike. We don't all need to go down. We should divide our strengths. Two of us should move all the loads up to 17-2 and set up camp, while the other two go for the lost gear." Joff continued, "Dick has more experience on crampons than you do, Mike. He should go down. We need your strength up here to move the loads. Dick and I are going down, and you and Jerry get camp set up." So, in the middle of the Alaskan night, Joff and Dick started heeling down Denali's unknown slope at high speed and were soon out of sight. Mike and I rearranged our remaining loads, then started up. I thought we were past the ridge's difficulties, but we soon came to a buttress that nearly blocked our passage. We climbed around it on the left by clambering up a steep trough. We did not know that this was the fabled Washburn's Thumb. Above this obstacle, it was hard work with our heavy packs, and we climbed for a long time over and around rocks on the ridge. After almost an hour, Mike and I pulled up onto the edge of the small plateau at 17,200 feet and saw Denali's upper slopes. I stared, but the great one was no longer beautiful. A cold, impassive Denali stared back at me. This stark view jolted me, and the seriousness of our position began to sink in. Mike and I dropped our packs and perched on a rock without speaking. I stared at the mountain and tried to think it through again. It had taken us longer to get up here than I had hoped, and there was that tricky buttress on the ridge. Joff and Dick might not be able to add another tough hour to their already heroic effort. Worse yet, what if they didn't find a stove? We would then run back to 14,200 feet, and the camp here didn't make any sense. Looking at Denali, I said, "Mike, this is too far up, and we're getting too strung out. Let's leave some stuff here, but take the tent and bags back to 16.8. Joff and Dick will be exhausted, but I think we can pitch the tent on the ridge right where your pack went off. If they have a stove, we can brew up, sleep for a few hours, then come back up here. If they have no stove, we'll run back to 14.2. Much calmer now, all Mike said was, "You're right, let's get going." We cached some food, fuel, and wands, then started back down. When we got back to the spot where the pack fell, we looked down for Joff and Dick. They were still far below, but moving slowly up, so at least they were okay. We pitched our four-man McKinley tent right on the ridge. There was barely room for it, and we couldn't walk around the tent on one side. We did our best to anchor the tent with ice screws in the hard-packed snow, but it was a precarious camp. I knew that a strong wind could blow us right off the ridge, but hopefully we would only be here for a few hours. I scanned the horizon carefully. The weather was still perfect, and the sky was lightening for the new day. It was July 4, Independence Day, and just maybe summit day. Exhausted, Joff and Dick made it back to the ridge at 5 a.m. Joff said, "We found most of the stuff, but only one stove." Then they dove into the tent. I said, "That's great. One stove is all we need. Get into your bags and we'll brew up." I fished the precious stove from Mike's icy pack, handed it to Mike, and said, "Get this going while I unstuff the bags." 2 minutes later, Mike announced, "The stove doesn't work." I stammered, "What? Give me that thing." Mike persisted, "The stove won't work. There's no flame spreader." I examined the stove and confirmed that this flame spreader was indeed gone. Joff and Dick were already asleep, but we roused them and asked if they had the flame spreader. Joff awoke long enough to explain, "We were lucky to find one stove. It was just sitting there in its bag. We grabbed it and put it in the pack. If the spreader isn't in the bag or loose in the pack, then it's gone." I carefully examined everything in the pack, but there was no flame spreader. During the long fall, the vital flame spreader had slipped off the stove stem and escaped from the stove bag. Without the flame spreader, gas shot out in a dangerous stream, and we could not ignite it without creating a Roman candle. After climbing all day and all night, we were very thirsty, so as Mike and I went to work to solve the stove problem, I just said, "This is a different kind of race, Mike. We've got to be creative, since we have no choice. Hold this spoon over the gas jet while I try to light it." To our amazement, it worked. Well, sort of. If we held the spoon perfectly still, a flame appeared around it. If we moved the spoon, the flame popped out, leaving gas jetting into the tent, which was a formula for another disaster. Hunched in our bags, the four of us gathered around our broken stove like hungry hobos. Right now we would settle for a cup of cold water each. One of us worked the on-off switch knob, one held the spoon, one worked the lighter, and one held the pot over the precious flame. The spoon holder had the toughest job, as he had to hold the spoon perfectly still. We took turns at spoon holding for 2 hours and managed to get 2 cups of water. We each got a swallow, which was better than nothing. At 7 a.m., no one could hold the spoon steady anymore, so we decided to get some sleep. We stuffed snow into our water bottles, wiggled deeper into our bags, pressed the bottles against our empty bellies, and dozed fitfully. I stirred at 11 a.m. and tried to focus, but had a bad case of cotton mouth and dehydration. Miserable, I thought that we should go back to 14-2 and get the spare stove and start another summit push. Mike, already wide awake, sat bolt upright and roared, "I've been thinking about it all night. We've gotta go for it." I undid the tent door and looked out as fresh air smacked me in the face. The weather was still perfect, and there was no wind. If we went down, we might not get another chance, and we all knew that this was the pivotal moment of our expedition. There are times to be careful and times to go for it. On this memorable occasion, we went for it. We forced a little gulp down our parched throats, got another swallow from our bottles, stuffed hard candies into our pockets, collapsed the tent, put on our crampons, and started for Denali's summit at 1 p.m. Touching Greatness. Joff and I went first on one rope, while Mike and Dick followed on a second rope. I led up the now familiar ridge to our cache at 17,200 feet, where we picked up some extra wands and grabbed a few more candies. After Joff post-holed across the small plateau, I attacked the long slope leading diagonally up toward Denali Pass. This was the slope where John Day and the Whitakers had fallen 3 years earlier. We had not forgotten, and we went into our Summit Club climb mode, banishing all extraneous thoughts and focusing only on the climb. As I led up the slope, I steadily felt stronger and more determined. Looking north, I only saw tundra, lakes, and an occasional cotton candy cloud thousands of feet below. The tundra was so far beneath us that it looked like a work of art. I felt like the rest of the world was the painting now, and that it was sitting still watching me, the Earth's only living creature. Looking west and south, I saw 4-acre and open skies beyond, which meant that the weather was still perfect. I started a long ascending traverse to reach the pass, but about halfway up, I paused and stared up the slope at a great shortcut. The shortcut was steeper, but the snow was good, and I felt stalwart. I looked back at Joff and said, "Why go all the way over to the pass when we can just go straight up?" He gave me all the encouragement I needed when he said, "Summit Club forever, summit fever, go for it, bro." Starting up the fall line, I responded with our old club call, "Squirrel's gonna climb these mountain." Kicking steps up the perfect snow, I sucked either a piece of ice to get some liquid or hard candy to get some sugar. My strategy paid off, and I continued to feel better. Joff's yodel gave me our signal that he was ready to lead, but without breaking stride, I waved him off and hollered back, "I've got it to the top of the slope. You take it to the summit from there." This was the crux. It was my lead, and if required, I would kick steps for 20 hours to get to the top of this slope. I settled into a rhythm and climbed on into the Alaskan afternoon. We passed 18,200 feet, the elevation of Denali Pass between the North and South Peaks, and pressed on. There is a dream that makes people come to the heights, and I was living the dream. It was summit day. I forgot about the lower world, sun was on my back, and I felt fantastic. The snow sparkled as it flew away from my boots in graceful arcs. Step by shining step, I approached the venerable upper slopes on one of Earth's great peaks. Afternoon was slowly slipping into early evening when Joff and I pulled up onto the crest at the top of the steep slope. As we sat at 18,700 feet, well above Denali Pass, Joff said, "Our shortcut worked." The comment needed no reply. The view down the other side startled us. We had been living with the same views for 2 weeks and now reveled in our new chimerical vista. For the first time, we had a clear view of Denali's North Peak. It was 2 miles away and still higher than we were, its graceful summit ridges crowned ramparts that fell away into the Harper Glacier Basin below. The Harper drew our eyes northeast, where Denali fell away for miles into deep shadows. Beyond the shadows lay the painting-perfect tundra with its jeweled lakes. Joff and I were now as high as Mexico's Orizaba, the highest peak that the Summit Club had climbed. Our eyes still traced a long line up nature's screen to the summit of the Great One, which was still a mile away and 1,600 feet above us. We were poised to smash our altitude record. With crampons squeaking on the hard snow, Joff led us up into the evening light. A muted pink glow infused the snow as we passed Archdeacon's Tower. When stopped to eat some candy, I noticed that we were now higher than the North Peak, which, while impressive, was just a false summit. Now, only the highest snows in North America remained above us. Mike and Dick had fallen behind, and for the moment, Joff and I were alone. As we sat together munching and eyeing the final 700-foot slope to the summit, we felt our old Summit Club companionship. The weather was still perfect, and we sensed the great summit's closeness. We were strangely quiet, as our usual banter and macho blustering were completely unnecessary in this sacred place. The hard snow here was unlike anything I had seen below. It was not clear like ice, but it felt just as hard. Unknown winds had scoured these slopes for centuries, leaving graceful, curving ripples. Calmed, I sensed permanence in these snow slopes, as if the rest of the land was soft and might suddenly wash away, whereas these sculpted slopes were here forever. The rigid ripples caught the evening alpenglow as Joff and I continued up into another colorful fairyland. Denali's summit slopes became my entire universe. I could no longer even see the painting that represented the rest of the world, and this new detached dimension captivated me. Halfway up the final slope, I wondered if this mountain would ever stop going up, but I did not break stride. We were on a mission that could no longer be denied. When Joff and I stepped onto the summit ridge, the view down the south face made our toes tingle. But with the summit so close, we still did not break stride. We danced up the concluding ridge in a state of rapidly compressing space, time, and experience, and in the final intoxicating steps, we executed an old Summit Club routine. Without slowing, we each coiled half the rope and arrived at the highest point together. We just stood there puffing until Joff broke the silence by hollering, "Highest point in North America! Yowza!" This time a reply seemed necessary, so I let out our Summit Club yodel. "Wee honkin'!" Then for Sheldon added, "You bet!" It was 10 p.m., and with the sun kissing the northern horizon, we took some pictures before the light faded. In all of central Alaska, we were the only people still in the sun. It was windless, but our thermometer read minus 16 degrees and was dropping at an alarming rate. Cold, we pulled on our down parkas. When we saw Mike and Dick approaching the summit ridge, I let out another wee honkin' to encourage them. When they joined us on the summit at 10:30 p.m., Mike cried, "We did it! A clean sweep!" Joff and I tried to unfold our frozen, homemade Summit Club flag, but I had to pry the prize with my ice axe to finally get it open. The ink had bled through the cheap cloth, so our flag looked like a double exposure. But we posed with it like heroes anyway. Then we tied it to a wand and plunged it into the highest point. The gesture seemed silly, since our presence here was triumph enough. I tried to absorb all the views and understand the message, but there was too much. The Alaska Range swept away to the east and west as far as I could see. There were more peaks than I could count, but we were higher than all of them. Deep blues folded into darkness in the chasm below Denali's south face. I saw Hunter and Foraker, but they were far below and strangely distant. This was Denali's moment. My only perception was that we were touching greatness. We had not conquered the Great One, but we had kissed it. Ours was the 34th ascent of Denali. Just before we put the thermometer away, it read minus 20 degrees, and Dick complained that his feet were cold. Mine were too, since our boots were marginal. It was time to move. Starting down a little after 11 p.m., Mike and Dick zoomed off to see if Dick's feet would warm up. My feet did warm when I started moving, so Joff and I followed at a more sedate pace. Reluctant to rush away, we soaked up the Alaskan night. Descending the shortcut slope, I kept repeating my new mantra, "Don't have an accident, don't have an accident." Step by step, we moved carefully down the mountain. We stopped at our precarious high camp at 16,800 feet and slept for a few hours. Dick's feet warmed up in his sleeping bag, and in the morning we had our next surprise. Dick had some frostbite on his toes. We were still high on the mountain, and our new mission was to get Dick down before frostbite blisters formed, which would render him immobile. We shot down to 14,200 feet and melted snow with the spare stove until we had consumed a gallon of liquid apiece. This was our first real liquid in 48 hours. Then we hurried down around Windy Corner and continued down to make camp near Kahilna Pass. As we started to prepare our first solid food in 3 days, we spilled some gas on the tent floor. We waited a long time for it to evaporate, but not long enough. When we set the running stove down, the whole tent floor popped into flame. This was the disaster we had worked so hard to prevent at high camp. Dick was in his sleeping bag, but still opened the door and slithered out in 2 seconds. I followed him out and threw snow back into the tent. Joff had his boots on and stomped like a dancing dervish while Mike grabbed the down gear. A few seconds later, Mike and Joff tumbled out of the tent in a cloud of smoke. We sat outside in disarray and realized that the mountain was still in command. It seemed as if Denali was determined to continue teaching us lessons. We inspected the damage and discovered that the fire had not destroyed anything. However, our new problem was that Joff had bent the stove stem in his wild stomping. Now, even our spare stove didn't work, and we sacked out again without getting our hot meal. The next morning, Mike and I sat down with the spare stove and repaired it, since we had no choice. We had to bend the stem without breaking it, so we carefully bent it just far enough so that it worked and no farther. There was no margin for error. Then Mike and I cooked up a huge meal while Joff doctored Dick's feet. He still didn't have frostbite blisters, so we set off down the Kahilna. Escape. We still planned to walk out to Talkeetna, but by the time we reached the southeast fork, it was clear Dick's feet could not handle the journey. In our absence, another team had flown in and was busy climbing Foraker's southeast ridge, which was only the second ascent of Foraker. They had left a radio on base camp, but after many attempts, we still had not raised anyone. Where was Sheldon when we needed him? After a day of discussion, we decided that Joff and I should walk out so that the four of us would not be stranded here forever. Joff and I left that night on hard snow with 70 pounds in the sled and light loads on our backs. We were now past the solstice, so it was noticeably darker at night. Our reward was that as we walked, the moon rose to frame the peaks on both sides of the glacier. As Joff and I cruised down the glacier, we felt expansive and started thinking about re-entering the rest of the world. After 6 miles, crevasses appeared in the glacier, and for some time we snaked through giant chasms with fragile snow bridges over them. Reaching a precarious overlook point, we looked down the glacier and realized that there was no way we could get through this maze. We needed to be on the glacier's edge, but even that route didn't look very likely. The Summit Club was in over its head on this one, so we turned around and slogged back up to the southeast fork. Even Denali's lowest slopes held lessons, and we were still detached from the outside world. We had climbed the mountain, but could we escape it? We sat around for 2 days trying to make the radio work. Then on July 9, as we lay dozing in the tent, Mike suddenly bolted upright and screamed, "A plane! A plane! I hear a plane!" The rest of us didn't hear anything and thought Mike was dreaming or losing it completely. We started with, "Hold it in, Mike, you're dreaming." Mike emphatically said, "No, I'm not dreaming. I hear a plane. Listen." We fell silent, cocked our ears, and there was the faintest, sweetest sound that we had ever heard. A tiny engine purring up the huge glacier. Somebody had indeed heard one of our radio calls, and when Sheldon got the word, he was zooming through the air within 10 minutes. Racing down the Kehiltna Glacier after our takeoff, Sheldon roared, "So, she was a howling success, eh?" Wanting to verify that the track team had really climbed Denali, but unable to discuss it over the plane's roar, I just bellowed, "Yowza!" Back in Sheldon's hangar, our physical escape was complete, but we had one more problem. We were starving. Pacing the hangar floor in the depths of night, I said, "What time does the Fairview open?" Pacing with me, Mike grumbled, "Not till 6. "What time is it now?" Mike's voice cracked when he said, "Only 3. Holding my stomach, I replied, "My God, we'll never make it." Proving that he was not asleep, Joff piped up from his sleeping bag, "The Fairview doesn't open until 7. Without showing his head, Dick rumbled from inside his bag, "We'll head over at 5 and wake him up. Now shut up." At 10 to 5, we could wait no longer. When the Fairview's proprietor came to the door in his bathrobe and slippers, we quickly explained our climb, the loss of stoves, and our current hunger. The man eyed us and seemed ready to tell us to come back at 7. We held our breath. Then an Alaskan twinkle came into his eyes. He swept the door wide and said, "Come on in, men. It's going to take a little while, but I'll fix you the breakfast of a lifetime. Sit right here." We tried to sit in the tiny anteroom, but when sounds and smells came from the kitchen, the only way we could contain ourselves was to pace in small circles, holding our tortured tummies. When the food started arriving, we dove into it, but our culinary savior just said, "Pace yourselves, men. There's plenty. The slower you eat, the more you can get down." Heeding this advice, I ate 12 eggs, 6 slabs of ham, 8 pieces of bacon, 4 pieces of thick sourdough toast slathered with butter and jam, 7 glasses of orange juice, 6 buttermilk pancakes overflowing with syrup, a plateful of home-style potatoes, 2 glasses of milk, and a large cinnamon roll. The Great One introduced me to the wow and taught me more lessons than I could easily count. At the tender age of 19, I had climbed 4 of North America's 10 highest peaks. At this rate, I would be done in no time. But Denali was just my first high northern summit and my first continent summit. I had no way of knowing how far and high other climbs would take me. But Denali had produced a howling first movement to my northern mountain symphony. Eclipse. I said my goodbyes to Dick, Mike, and Joff, then traveled alone into Alaska's interior to spend the rest of the summer working for the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. 16 days after standing on Denali's summit, I waited in an Alaskan meadow watching white, puffy summer clouds. A total solar eclipse was coming, and no human force could stop it. As I lay on my back, feeling the grass tickle the back of my neck, the moon slowly made love to the sun. Imperceptibly, an accelerating sensory rush occupied my meadow. It was not like twilight, not even a long Alaskan twilight. The landscape gradually took on an eerie hue. As queer shadows crept across the meadow, a large hole opened in the clouds as if by some celestial command. Birds on the wing sang their night songs, then all was silent for a hopeful moment. An abnormal pallor overtook the countryside as the totality shadow raced across the northern land. A tiny whirlwind tugged at my sweater, then vanished. For a figment, cosmic fear seized me, since the moon's movement was so powerful and undeniable. This event was from beyond the realm of the living, and I felt compelled to learn from it. Something tangible enveloped bird, man, and meadow, as moon and sun united. Awe overtook my fear as I merged with the prime mover. The sun's last salute was Bailey's beads, flashing for 3 suspended seconds. Then the sky was dark. The sun was gone. Simultaneously, the sun's corona and stars appeared. I stood transfixed by the celestial spectacle while solar coronal filaments played with the edges of my mind. A frightened bird fluttered overhead, and a flower started to close. Yet I felt strangely peaceful. This was not a summit, but my spirit was in alignment with Denali's family of summits. I stood at the eclipse's supreme syzygy of summit, self, and sun. Just as Denali's transcendent summit had done, this transcendent sight engraved my memory forever. Thanks for listening.